December 7th. It was exactly 77 years ago today that the Imperial Japanese Navy executed a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, pulling the United States into World War II. More than 2,000 American servicemen were killed that day. Many could not be identified and were buried in anonymous graves. An agency within the Pentagon has the mission of identifying these unknown casualties of war, and much of their work happens on the same base that was attacked in 1941. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
So this area has different names. I mean, sometimes people call it the Education Center or whatever, but it's basically where we can start walking through.
I'm standing outside a large open room. Inside that room are dozens of lab tables, each one holding a human skeleton.
These are actual remains of U.S. service members that we are in the process of identifying.
That was Dr. William Belcher, a forensic anthropologist with the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, the DPAA. He helps oversee one of two forensic laboratories used by the United States military to identify the remains of American service members killed in our nation's wars. Belcher's focus is on the final step of that mission, identification. But he told me it can take years of research before a set of remains arrives in the lab.
It's all based on a historical foundation of the historical research. So we have several different kinds of materials that we look at. Some are missing aircrew reports, some are unit histories, some are dealing with individual deceased personnel files that have accounts of their loss, missing aircrew reports, things like that. So we have several, I would say tons, of paper data that we have, and we're in the process of digitizing all that. But so a lot of people, when they look at the lab, they want to say, oh, this is the lab, this is where everything happens. But it's not true. This is basically the last stage. And, you know, you could think of it as a pyramid where the foundation of the research is what allows us to go out and be successful in the recovery and then off into the identification.
Once researchers have determined the probable location of a plane crash or battlefield gravesite, teams of scientists and military escorts will travel there to do a field excavation. The DPAA has recovered remains from all over Europe, Asia, and the Pacific Islands. Investigation teams have even been able to work in restrictive nations like North Korea and China. But the agency also works to determine the identity of so-called unknowns, unnamed Americans buried in national cemeteries. That was the case with one group of particularly well-preserved skeletons.
These are sort of special cases because these are from buried as unknowns up in the National Cemetery of the Pacific, or National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. They were found as unknowns. Most of this is dealing with Korean War. So everything we see in most of the bays here until we walk down to the end of the hall relate to the Korean War somehow. So these are primarily unknowns from the Korean War that were buried in the Punch Bowl Cemetery. And so because they were buried in caskets and things like that, they're very well preserved. But we do find other remains that are either on plane crashes that are more fragmentary, as well as have been exposed to the elements for 60-plus years.
Is there a typical condition for remains to come back in terms of either number or type of bones or tissue?
It just depends on the kind of incident. So if you have a high-speed jet aircraft during Vietnam that crashed in excess of 500 miles an hour and it was loaded with fuel, the bone is very fragmentary and burned, so it's a very high degree, so it almost looks like chalk. Whereas if you have a battlefield loss where somebody was buried in a fighting position like we see in North Korea, the bones are relatively well preserved, but the epiphyses of the ends of the bones tend to be eroded.
In a case like that, it can take some serious scientific ingenuity to determine even basic traits of the remains. Using display replicas, Dr. Belcher shows me just how hard it can be.
First thing is, like, if we have a collection of small fragmentary bone-like items, we want to separate out the non-bone. And so we have, for example, we have this fragment here that looks very much like a kneecap or a patella. Even the internal structure looks very much like that, but it's a piece of melted plastic.
So yeah, same shape, same size.
But it's a piece of plastic. And this here looks like it might be part of a finger, but it's actually a drip of fiberglass that's melted and dripped and formed a tear shape.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it even has the same kind of coloring that a bone might have.
So once we've separated out this non-osseous or non-bone material, then we want to look at, is it human animal or human bone? So one of the things that we want to do is, we've had people We have people on the staff that are experts in determining whether it's non-human animal versus human. And so some of the places that we go to excavate, people have been living for thousands of years. And so we do find people eating animals and discarding the remains in archaeological sites that have been reused as burial sites later on.
Once bones have been identified as human, work begins to identify physical traits of the deceased.
First thing is, like, if we have a collection of small fragmentary bone-like items, we want to separate out the non-bone. And so we have, for example, we have this fragment here that looks very much like a kneecap or a patella. Even the internal structure looks very much like that, but it's a piece of melted plastic.
So yeah, same shape, same size.
But it's a piece of plastic. And this here looks like it might be part of a finger, but it's actually a drip of fiberglass that's melted and dripped and formed a tear-shaped.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it even has the same kind of coloring that a bone might have.
So once we've separated out this non-osseous or non-bone material, then we want to look at, is it human animal or human bone? We have people on the staff that are experts in determining whether it's non-human animal versus human. And so some of the places that we go to excavate, people have been living for thousands of years. And so we do find people eating animals and discarding the remains in archaeological sites that have been reused as burial sites later on. So when we get some remains in and we begin to separate out into individuals, we want to perform what we call a biological profile. So this is where the forensic anthropologists come in. And the biological profile are the same kinds of things that you would see in the personnel file that we've been to compare that thing to. Male, is this person male or female? What is their race or ethnicity? How tall were they? How old were they? Those are the kinds of things that we want to try to look at. And so there's various indicators on the skeleton that we can begin to look at to determine that. And so if we have the pelvis or a fragment of the pelvis, we can help determine whether it's male or female based on different structure or aspects of it. Dealing because the female pelvis really is, through evolution, designed to birth this very large brain primate. And about 98 to 99% of the casualties that we're looking for are men, of course.
And I've heard anecdotally that some of the technicians can even tell the race of the deceased just by looking at the bones or, you know, make an informed guess. Mm-hmm. What are some of the indicators of that?
Well, if we have the mid-facial area, we can determine what the ethnicity or the race of the individual is. And forensic anthropology tends to look at African, European, or Asian as our standard designations. And like I said, there are several things that we can look at that are characteristics on the mid-facial or the skull area. There's also measurements that we can do on the bone. Like this skull here that I'm holding in my hand is a Caucasian, and these are all casts, but this is a Caucasian male. Caucasians tend to have a pretty small face. They also have a very narrow nose area, nasal area. And they also have very smooth spatulate-shaped teeth on the inside, on the lingual or tongue side of the teeth.
On the inside of the teeth.
Yeah. When we look at an Asian skull, because of the cheekbones, it tends to be a relatively large face. So, but we also have a relatively flat nasal area up here between the eyes. But the key thing also is that we have, you can see here, where there's sort of a dimple inside. And we call this shovel-shaped incisors because these look like an old-time snow shovel that you might see, not so much here in Hawaii.
These are the front two teeth.
Yeah, the front two teeth on the back, the lingual side. And so they have this divot on the inside, and this is called shovel shaping. This is very characteristic of about 98% of all Asian populations, and that includes Native Americans. And so these are some of the characteristics. There's other things, like I said, that we can look at of dealing with the shape of other bones as well as measurements on bones.
And it's probably somewhat uncommon for you to get a perfectly preserved skull like this, I would imagine, right?
Battlefield losses, it's relatively common. In some of the unknowns that were buried, like from Pearl Harbor attack, those are also relatively well preserved. But if you have an aircraft crash site and things like that, it's not so common.
In another part of the lab, we saw some of those Pearl Harbor unknowns. They were distinct from other sets of remains because the bones were almost completely black. Dr. Belcher said that's characteristic of casualties from the 1941 attack. Oil from destroyed and damaged ships penetrated all the way to the bones of sailors entombed in ships like the USS Oklahoma, the West Virginia, and the California. This has actually made identifying the sailors a little bit easier.
The oil and fuel from the ships, which is actually, when you think about it, people think, oh, they got saturated with oil, that's a bad thing. It's actually a very good thing because it inhibits microbial or fungal growth, and that fungal or microbial growth actually contaminates the DNA. So actually inhibiting that with the oil is a really good thing.
The agency is currently focusing on identifying remains from the USS Oklahoma, which sunk at Pearl Harbor with more than 400 men lost. Currently, DPAA has identified almost 200 of those. Work also continues on 50 unknowns from the USS California and the West Virginia. In many cases, it has only recently become possible to make those identifications. A set of remains may lie in storage for years before scientists develop the techniques necessary to confirm a service member's identity. DPAA scientists are currently exploring how radioactive isotopes in the body could be used to determine things like where a person lived and where they grew up.
So different isotopes occur in basically the groundwater or the bedrock of different areas in the world. So we're looking at things like carbon, oxygen, strontium, and nitrogen. Those are the four main ones. This is an old technique that's been used in archaeology, but we're starting to use it in forensics now. And what it is that you basically are what you eat or ingest or where you live. And so those isotopes get into your bones and they're preserved. And different isotopes give you a different picture of somebody, what they were eating or where they were living 2 weeks ago, where they grew up, where they may have moved off to, things like that. So different aspects that we can look at. But what we're trying to develop is what we call isoscapes, or a landscape of isotopes. And so we can look at that to determine where somebody lived. So if we have, let's just say for Korea, we have 5,000 casualties that we have in a group. And if we can say we need to narrow that down to a smaller number. And so we can say, okay, well, this guy's isotope signature matches L.A. And so we can say, okay, now we're just going to look at the L.A. casualties. And so, but if you look at a landscape of the United States, it's very colorful using different codes because the isotopic composition of the bedrock is very different. And this is the same thing that is used in different kinds of forensic and criminal cases like counterfeit Kobe beef. Because Kobe beef is from Kobe, Japan. And it can't be sold if it's under that name unless it's from Kobe, Japan. And so you can actually test the meat to determine where it came from in Japan. And it's the same concept. So we're using the bones to test where this person originally came from.
As we walked through the lab, one particular set of bones caught my eye. A partial skeleton was wrapped in an olive-green wool army blanket and covered in dirt. A patch of jet black hair still clung to the skull.
These are remains that we exhumed from the punch bowl this morning, and that they're in the process of being cleaned to prep for analysis.
And so where is this person from, do we know?
North Korea.
So this is a
person that died in North Korea and was brought back as what's called Operation Glory, where we exhumed the POW cemeteries in the 50s and brought the remains back here, and then they were buried. They couldn't analyze them, they could analyze them, but they couldn't determine the identification back in the 50s, and so they were buried as unknowns. And so the remains are usually, they were processed and then wrapped in a standard Army wool blanket.
I was going to say, it looks like a field blanket.
Yep. Wow. This is a tradition that's within mortuary affairs and graves registration services, is that the bodies are wrapped in a wool blanket. And then sent home for burial.
I just exhumed this morning.
For Dr. Belcher, this type of work has a very personal element.
I come from a military family. I never served, but my father was in the military for 23 years. So he fought in Korea and Vietnam. And so I have a different perspective on this because, except for the grace of God, my dad could be one of these people. So when I'm working on a case, that's how I think in the back of my mind, is that I want to do the best job I can because this could be my father.
That sentiment was echoed by the agency's director, retired Air Force General Kelly McKegg. He's a graduate of Damien Memorial School in Honolulu and came home to mark the 77th anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
For us, it's a commitment to the service members themselves who made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of this nation, its liberties, and its freedoms. But there's also a commitment to the families of the missing. Those are the ones we primarily serve. For the veterans whose comrades in arms are missing, there's that sense of connection, that sense of recovery. But it sends a strong signal to the veterans of all wars that this nation will spare no expense. And the last category that I think this work speaks to are those currently serving in uniform, that this nation will spare no expense to ensure that they, should they go missing, will be brought home to their families.
And why do you think the United States and the U.S. government have made such a point to create this mission and to fund it when other nations don't necessarily share that commitment?
Number one, I think it defines us as a nation, that the values that we've placed on service to country, on the fact of individuals going off to combat and making the supreme sacrifice, is something that we have that sacred obligation, almost a moral imperative too, that I think this, again, speaks to our values, that you know, this is something that, again, defines us as to who we are as a nation, that we commit the resources, the energy, and the focus toward this effort.
We don't really have any missing, any MIA service members from 20 years of war in Iraq or Afghanistan, which is a good thing. But do you think that you folks are going to work yourselves out of a job someday?
We won't, because unfortunately the numbers are staggering. From the conflicts that we work, we're bounded by World War II through Operation Iraqi Freedom. There are 82,000 that are still unaccounted for. Now, majority of them are deep water at sea losses, and so we estimate that the recoverable number is 34,000. But as you can see, doing the math, it is still a steep, staunch challenge ahead of us.
450 of those made the ultimate sacrifice 77 years ago today. From Pearl Harbor, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And if you want to hear more about the POW MIA Accounting Agency's efforts to identify missing American service members, head over to our website. We'll have a longer interview with the agency's director posted there. Find it at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra, celebrating the season with Handel's Messiah, December 15th and 16th at the Iao Theater. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org and mauionstage.com.
250 million years ago, the most dangerous predator in Utah was not a dinosaur. It was their reptile cousin, the crocodile-like phytosaur.
They were super successful for 30 million years, and then they died out.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, the story of what led to the downfall of the phytosaurs and the rise of the dinosaurs. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, a float down the longest river in the state. Located just a short distance from downtown Hilo on Waianui Nui Avenue is this 18-mile waterway that runs through a 16-acre state park of the same name. The area is home to many beautiful landmarks. The first is Rainbow, or Waianui Nui Falls. It stands 80 feet tall and drops over an ancient cave said to once be the home of Hina, the mother of demigod Maui. A few miles upriver is an excellent view of Pe'epe'e Falls and Boiling Pots. This is the roughest part of the river because as the water falls, it enters an area of rapids where the water rushes through old lava rocks and tubes, giving a bubbling and boiling appearance, hence the name Boiling Pots. A hiking trail runs along the river, but the trail is dangerously close to the lava tubes and drownings have happened in that area. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this river? And for bonus points, what's the meaning of its name? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, Moyer Financial, and Kaiser Permanente.
Federal lawsuit cast a shadow over the dedication of a statue to honor Hawaii Congresswoman Patsy Mink. The art piece stands to acknowledge Mink, the author of Title IX, the law requiring equality in education and athletics. But hours after the ceremony yesterday, the American Civil Liberties Union stood at the feet of the bronze sculpture to draw attention to what they say are inequalities in our public schools. Josh Wish is executive director of the ACLU. He said the ACLU hoped to avoid a lawsuit. He had asked that the Department of Education set up a plan to address its concerns by the start of the 2018 school year, but it got no response.
Title IX was passed almost half a century ago. I think that 50 years is enough time to get your budgets in order and figure out how you're going to comply with a federal law that bears the name of Hawaii's own Congresswoman Patsy Mink, who passed it and wrote it. Second of all, when we reached out to DOE in the first place in response to the article from Civil Beat, we were looking at ways to try to resolve this and come up with a plan for how they would use these facilities in an equitable fashion until perhaps they could build some new facilities as well. The point is, the DOE has facilities for athletics. They shouldn't just be boys' facilities or girls' facilities. These are facilities that need to be treated equally, and the female athletes aren't getting that right now.
And joining us this morning is Civil Beat reporter Suvan Lee, whose story the ACLU credited. Now, this really was a reality check, Suvan. Good job flagging the situation.
Thank you, Catherine, and thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, what got you started looking at this?
So, yes, this story did come back, came out in February earlier this year. Well, what really turned me on to it was a legislative information hearing during the past session in which a representative representing the Ewa Beach area noted, just kind of made a comment during a hearing about the shocking lack of a girls' athletic locker room at Campbell High School, which was in his district. So that really keyed me on to the issue, and therefore I wrote that story.
Now, you know, the ACLU brought in outside counsel for this case. Let's listen to what Legal Aid at Work's Elizabeth Kirsten had to say about this lawsuit.
What we're seeing at Campbell High School is unfortunately all too common at high schools around the country. We're seeing that girls are not getting a fair chance to participate in sports. Nearly 100 more girls would get to play if there was equity at Campbell. And that's just wrong under Title IX. Some of the facilities issues that we've seen already at this school are very troubling. Girls' water polo wasn't given a place to practice until well into the season, and it affected their ability to compete and win as a team. We're seeing unequal facilities for the softball players who are being relegated to an inferior field as compared to baseball. And we're also seeing girls in fear of retaliation because when they came forward to raise concerns, the administration threatened to cancel their team. That's just wrong.
Now, you know, at that news conference yesterday, that was the one thing that really struck me is the allegations that, you know, there was retaliation.
Right. Yeah. You and I were both there at that press conference, and that's outlined in the complaint. So allegedly, when the girls' water polo team complained about the fact that they didn't have a secure pool to practice in, that they had to practice, you know, in the open ocean or even on dry land, administrators allegedly retaliated by threatening to yank the program altogether or even refusing to sign an outside $1,000 grant that would have helped fund the girls' water polo team. So that did come to light in yesterday's complaint.
Yeah, I was amazed, too, about the descriptions of how the girls would have to sometimes change on the field or in the teacher's closets or run to the fast food restaurant's bathroom.
Sure. And these are findings that, you know, the February story that I wrote, brought out, because when I was talking to these girls softball and track and field members, they pointed out the fact that the lack of a standalone athletic girls locker room at Campbell High forced them to change in classrooms on the bleachers, run to Burger King to use a restroom, whereas the boys baseball team members, football team members, you know, have a standalone locker room. But, you know, I'd just like to point out that the ACLU lawsuit really covers so much more ground than just the lack of a girls locker room. It really points out inequities in funding, in publicity for girls' teams, in the scheduling of gameplay, competition, travel off island, because Title IX is more than just access to facilities. It's about leveling the playing field for all those other aspects of competition and play, which, as any parent here might know, is more than just the field or the locker room. It's about all those other logistical components that makes playing sports here so empowering for young students.
And this wasn't the first time that the DOE was sued over this inequality.
That's right. This complaint does point out the extensive history of noncompliance by the Hawaii Department of Education around this issue. In fact, in 2010, ACLU of Hawaii brought a lawsuit against the County of Maui and DOE regarding Maui's Baldwin High and the really poor quality of the girls' softball team there. In that case, a judge did grant an order in which the DOE had to comply and build a new softball team. So that really did affect positive change. So I think a lot of legal advocates are optimistic that and hopeful that the filing of this complaint yesterday will light a similar fire under the DOE to do something and come up with a comprehensive, concrete plan to address gender inequities in the schools here.
Now, when I contacted the DOE yesterday for comment, I just got a couple sentence response, I was told that the school board did actually take up this issue and, from what I understand, really thought that they were in compliance.
I am not sure about what the school board is aware of at this point. I know that there was a DOE presentation to the board a couple months ago indicating how they're going to sort of shift money around in the budget to perhaps give this gender inequity Title IX issue a little bit more greater attention. But as far as I know, board members, haven't actually stated, at least publicly, what they do or don't know about the Title IX compliance issue. I imagine that this is really this lawsuit is really going to, have them take more notice of it and perhaps bring it up at a future meeting. But it remains to be seen.
Yeah, I was struck by the comment that Elizabeth Kirsten had about changing the culture.
Sure. You're referring to a comment yesterday at the press conference in which outside counsel of legal aid, Elizabeth Kirsten, said that what has to happen for compliance resolution is a culture change. And when we asked about that, she said it really comes from the top. It really comes from leadership. And I think she was referring to not just the DOE leadership, but school leadership. Principals, athletic directors, and I think that is where they really have the power and the authority and the purse strings to really be able to direct equitable funding to girls' teams or be able to come up with a plan to even, use alternating access for locker rooms, for instance. Things that the ACLU pointed out yesterday doesn't take that much money to fix, really. It's really just, a solution.
Right. Something to watch. But thank you so much, Suvan.
Sure thing. Thank you.
That was reporter Suvan Lee, who broke the story raising the issue about inequality in our public schools. To read her stories on this issue, check out civilbeat.org. Kupa Aina translates their name to simple island people, but there's nothing simple about their blend of traditional and contemporary Hawaiian music, chant, reggae, blues, folk, and spoken word. We welcome them back to the Atherton Studio on December 15th. Tickets to Kupa Aina at hprtickets.org. Discounted for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management. No veto override. The Honolulu City Council this week failed to get enough votes to override the mayor's veto of a proposal to delay the implementation of the mandatory sprinkler bill. HPR's Wayne Yoshioka joins us in the studio with more on this issue.
Good morning, Catherine. You know, Mayor Caldwell vetoed Bill 72, and that would have allowed high-rise condominiums without fire sprinkler systems an additional 2 years to complete a life system evaluation and retrofit. And, you know, it added 2 more years. And that override required 6 out of the 9 member votes. So it failed. But Honolulu Fire Department Chief Manuel Nevis testified that the Marco Polo condominium fire last year that killed 4 people, injured about a dozen others, and caused an estimated $100 million damage justifies the current timetable for mandatory fire sprinkler systems. So here's Fire Chief Nevis.
July 14, 2017, the day of the Marco Polo, was one of the worst days of my life. It's that day that I had to send 120 of my firefighters into that raging fire. We had 2 Maydays, and a Mayday is when a firefighter either lost or they think they're going to die. We were lucky we didn't have any injuries. But you know, sprinklers buy time, and what time buys is life. So please, I beg you, we'll override the veto.
And you know, Catherine, you covered that story. It ruined and destroyed about 200 other units. And what they're saying is a fire sprinkler system would just, you know, leave it to one unit. One unit would get destroyed. So the vote ended up with 5 members in favor of the override. And as we know, 1 vote short. So Council Member Ikaika Anderson was absent, but, you know, he would have sided with the mayor and voted against the override, and that would not have changed, really, the outcome. So Carol Fukunaga, who introduced Bill 72, maintains that seniors who live in high-rises 75 feet in height and built before 1975, when the mandatory fire sprinkler law went into effect, cannot afford the high cost of sprinkler retrofits. She estimated somewhere between $10,000 and, you know, $12,000 per unit. So the mayor and the fire chief maintain that the costs aren't that high. And again, here's Chief Nevis.
We have a building right now that's being retrofitted, and the cost came in at $8,000 per unit. And with the $2,000 homeowner's exemption credit, it comes down to $6,000 per unit. For $6,000 for each unit, they can do the entire lobby, the hallways, and the individual apartments.
So right now, with the veto override failing, condominium associations and unit owners have 3 years for a life system evaluation and 5 years to retrofit their buildings with fire sprinklers.
You know, I think it was today's paper, I read a letter to the editor from someone who was concerned about this mandatory law, and they said, oh, we have asbestos in our ceilings, so that would add another $10,000 or more to the cost of the $6,000. And they said it's a hardship.
It is a hardship because if you look at it, the buildings that were built before 1975 are 43 years and older, and they have other issues. They have to replace their water pipes. They have to do their, you know, sewage systems. And we're talking about a lot of assessments for these poor unit owners, and a fire sprinkler on top of that would add a lot of cost.
You live in a high rise not too far from Marco Polo.
Not too far. It was built in 1977, so we have sprinkler systems. We have 12 sprinkler heads in our apartment, so, you know, it's not an issue with us. But you go right next door to the Alawai Towers, and they have to replace their water pipes, their sewer pipes, and to do a retrofit of their sprinkler systems would be a lot of money, too.
Now, I know I drive past the Marco Polo building every morning to come to work, and I always look up to see, you know, what work is going on in that building. But, you know, I was struck by Chief Nevis's interview that you had where he talked about it was the worst day of his life. He sent all his men in there, and we listened to those communication tapes, and it was really heartbreaking because those battalion chiefs were really worried for their men because for a while there, they didn't know where they were.
And, you know, Chief Nevis said that, you know, normally on a regular fire, they consume about 2 tanks of oxygen. And in this one, each one of them consumed about 8 tanks of oxygen. So it was a long-fought fire, 7 alarms, 120 firefighters. Amazing.
Right. And Marco Polo, we should say, the residents did vote to install sprinklers. I don't know where they're at in that process, but I know many of those poor residents are displaced. Some have not gotten into their units mm-hmm. still as they make their way through this. And there's all the lawsuits that they have to contend with.
And all the owners have to contend with devaluation of their units. You know, the Marco Polo prices for units just really tanked after that fire on July 14th. And so you got to think about, okay, $6,000, even $12,000 to spend to retrofit your apartment. You know, that could be worth a lot more if you lose money on the valuation.
Right. I don't live in a high rise, but I know one of the fire chiefs told me, whenever you go on any building, you look to see where the fire exits are because your life could depend on that.
And really, no amount of money can justify a loss of life. Bottom line.
Yeah, it's a sad chapter in our history, but an important one, and we'll just see how this plays out in the weeks to come.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks so much. That was HPR's political reporter, Wayne Yoshioka. To hear his full report, go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Also this week, the Honolulu City Council gave their final approval for a bill that would change the way food trucks operate in Haleiwa. The trucks have ballooned in popularity over the past few years, maybe nowhere more so than the North Shore. The Main Street area was declared a special district in 1984, and that's at the crux of this issue. City Council Chair Ernie Martin has worked 2 years to resolve this.
This has been a work in progress. This bill actually started 2 years ago with discussions within the Chamber of Commerce at Haleiwa itself. It's a very tough bill. It was a very tough bill to work on. But I think the latest version you have before you, unfortunately, I think those who are concerned with the possible closure of their business, as the director had testified in response to Councilmember Fukunaga's question, it would alleviate their concerns that they would be affected and would be forced to cease operation. That consideration was given in drafting this hand-carried FD1. So I would ask for your support. It's probably one of the final measures I have pending in my office before I leave.
And Montia Miller was representing the North Shore Chamber of Commerce. Here's how she described the situation.
What we're trying to do is to protect the special district and bring the lunch wagons into compliance over time.
Sounds simple enough, right? Well, not according to many of the food truck operators. Here is Troy Nitchie, owner of Giovanni's Aloha Shrimp Truck.
I have no problem working with the community to better the feel and the atmosphere of Haleiwa, but I don't know if there's something in this bill that is surreptitiously going to put me out of business in a year. We're already in compliance with all the applicable rules and laws to do business. And this is going to force us to become familiar and meet an entirely new standard of regulation. And I know a lot of my fellow lunch truck owners and business owners feel the same way. They're very trepidatious about this bill. They don't know how it's going to be employed or how it's going to be enforced or whether it's going to be used as a stick against them to drive them out of business.
So why the confusion? Well, you can hear for yourself. Here's Councilmember Kimberly Pine reading just a few of the bill's recent modifications.
In section 21-9.90 4J7B, it deletes the requirement that a traffic study and adds a requirement for a parking management plan deletes this requirement in paragraph D, which required a parking management plan only if three or more MCEs operate on one zoning lot. It revises the new section 21-9.90-4J7C to require that mobile commercial establishment operating hours must end no later than
Well, half a dozen food truck operators and employees appeared before the council, all of them opposed to the measure. They worry about the rules, which go so far as to detail what color trucks can be. Here's what Michael Stacey, owner of the Big Wave Shrimp Truck, had to say about it.
Originally, this bill set out with very good intentions. The objective was to limit the growth of food trucks in Haleiwa. Instead, this bill has gotten hijacked by a few restaurant owners and a few people that just don't like food trucks. This bill is exactly the reason why Hawaii is considered one of the worst states in the country for small business. It's putting so many restrictions on us. It limited us, originally it limited us to 400 feet between food lots. Now it's grown to 1,500 feet. Why is that? The reason why this is a very cleverly disguised bill to eliminate food trucks in Haleiwa. If one food truck was to get that permit, all the other ones wouldn't be able to get permitted.
And food truck owner Terry Hort had a different problem with the bill.
As of about 3:45 p.m. yesterday, they were still making changes to it. I got the final copy at 4:30 yesterday. Each time this bill gets voted on, they move it to another committee, and the wording that we're stuck with now has nothing to do with the way the bill started and went through all the other committee procedures. What they voted on then is not the bill that we have today. This is an attempt by brick and mortar large restaurants in Haleiwa to do nothing more than to limit their competition. We have hurt them in the last 10 years. This is the way, instead of advertising their way out of it or improving their businesses, they're going to have the city council do away with us. We have spent a ton of money. We've paved the place. We've landscaped the place. We've hired parking attendants. Everything that the city has asked us to do, we've done. All with the idea that if we do everything you want, you'll leave us alone, let us do our businesses. But it never ends.
And Mary Nitschi, who works with the Giovanni Shrimp Trucks, had this to say.
We've been in Haleiwa for going on just over 22 years. We employ a staff of over 34 people, a third of whom would risk losing their jobs should we not be able to comply enough to get a permit. My biggest issue with this bill is not requiring parking. It's not requiring a beautification of the land or even to stay in compliance with the color scheme of the historic district. My issue is in the permits and the process and rules that they have set forth in us to gain that permit. The rules are not fair for our businesses compared to the brick and mortar buildings. They're requiring additional parking. They're requiring additional space for beautification that is not required from brick and mortar businesses. The parking in Haleiwa is an issue no matter where you are. The parking on Oahu is an issue no matter where you are. Why I should be required to have more parking spaces than a brick and mortar building, why I should be required to have a parking attendant when there's no parking attendants in the parking stalls for the brick and mortar buildings, it's discriminatory and it should not be allowed. And final conclusion of that, it's also very well known that to require a permit from the city is a very hard task to complete, and a year generally is not enough time. It took us over 2 years just to be able to get permits for a commissary. It often takes over a year to be able to get a permit for parking spaces. A year is not enough time to take existing businesses, bring them into compliance, and expect them to go through the legal proceedings to acquire those permits. You are effectively putting us out of business and ruining the lives of many, many people.
Now, the measure did have supporters. Here's Winston Welsh from the Outdoor Circle. He underscored why there are special protections for Haleiwa. The town is protective of its character, and the rules may be used as a model for other communities across the state.
We don't want to put anybody out of business, but just to keep the character of the town, and as opposed to an uncontrolled proliferation of some of the mobile food trucks that we see here. The bill also does other things. It protects and expands the view planes. It keeps Haleiwa a special place with a special district because of these slightly tighter regulations. And it does serve as a model, maybe perhaps as we look down the road for food trucks around the islands, as far as having places for people to wash their hands and parking regulations, and just having a more civilized and organized way that we can have and accommodate these trucks.
Now, Bill 45 passed the City Council with unanimous approval. Mayor Kirk Caldwell will now decide whether or not to sign it into law. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation. Stay with us. You know, it's great to get your feedback. And after we talked with Gregory Koob about delisting the Hawaiian hawk, the eo, from the federal endangered species list, Janice from Kailua Kona called in with her concern for the raptors in her neck of the woods.
Aloha. My question is regarding the threat of rodent poison being ingested when eo kill an infected rat or mouse. I've seen that this has happened before, and I wonder how much of a threat that is. Also, traffic. We found a dead EO by the side of the road in Halualoa a few weeks ago. It was hit by a car. Despite the increasing population, there are some threats that seem to keep certain neighborhoods of EO still in danger. And another thing is that we notice the cutting down of trees, even if they're non-native, like monkey pod trees, seems to disrupt the patterns of EO. And we've been told by ornithologists here that even those trees are used as markers, like maps for the EO, and if they're gone, that they, you know, can not necessarily get lost, but that their patterns of life are disrupted, and we don't know how negatively that might be.
We also heard from a couple of you following our show on growing hemp in Hawaii. We start with Daniel.
I'm familiar with growing marijuana, the sativa and ruderalis in Northern California, and we had a common problem with rats. They're wood rats, and they would devour the entire plant. So I was wondering if that's going to be an issue here with the local rats. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Hollis Dana. I'm calling from Kauai. What is being done to look into the future about how the hemp is going to be processed, manufactured, used? In other words, are we going to spend a whole bunch of money shipping it back to the mainland to be manufactured or processed, or are we considering keeping it in the islands and creating our own way to manufacture and process and make use of the product? Thank you.
Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. Earlier in the show, we asked you to identify Hawaii's longest river. Located near downtown Hilo, Wailuku River measures 18 miles in length and runs through the Wailuku River State Park. There are many beautiful landmarks along the river, many of which can be seen from numerous viewing points in the park. The first is Rainbow Falls, an 80-foot waterfall that drops over an ancient cave said to be once the home of Hina, the mother of the demigod Maui. A couple of miles upriver are Pe'epe'e Falls and Boiling Pots. This is the roughest part of the river because the water that flows over Pe'epe'e rushes through old lava tubes and rocks, creating high rapids, and so the appearance of boiling water. We also asked you for the meaning of Wailuku, which translates to waters of destruction. The title is fitting because of the dangerous rapids and low-lying trails. Numerous drownings have occurred in this area, so we suggest you stick to the parking lots and constructed viewpoints for your safety. And congratulations to Freddie from the Big Island. You got it right. We understand you and your family are on your way to go camping. We are all jealous.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
That's it for this week. Coming up next week, we talk climate change and migration in the Pacific. When your atoll floods, where do you go? We'd like to hear from you. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. This program produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congrisby. The backyard theme, John DeMello. And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us Monday. Pick up the conversation.